Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Ancient Warfare Podcast. I will be your host this evening, day, whenever you're listening. I'm Murray Dahm. I'm the assistant editor of the magazine. And joining me are Mark DeSantis, Lindsay Powell, and Mark McCaffrey. And our topic for conversation today is The Rise of the Roman Legion, Part 2. You can look up the earlier Part 1 if you are so intrigued. This was episode issue 15.4 of the magazine, where we looked at the Roman Legion roughly from the period of the Second Punic Wars in the late 3rd century BC, all the way through to, dare I say it, the reforms of Marius in the late second century BC, early first century BC. And the reason that I say, dare I say it, is of course that that now is no longer as part of the kind of accepted wisdom as it used to be. Once upon a time, the reforms of Marius were just, they were solid rock of Roman legionary development. And now they're less than sand, really, I think. So Mark was going to talk us through the changes between the legion prior to the Second Punic War and then what happens in the second century BC.
To my point of view, if we take a look at the difference between, say, the Polybian legion, the legion that we get from book 6 of Polybius's histories that he talks about either as being in effect during the Punic Wars or down to his time, roughly in the 140s, it seems that we have roughly four different types of soldiers in the legion. In the front, there would have been the velites. Those were the young men who were skirmishers. Behind them would have been the hastati, who were armed with sword and shield. Behind them were the principes. Now, the hastati were young men. The principes, armed just like the hastati, except that they were men in the prime of their lives. In the rear ranks, you had the triarii, who were older men, the most experienced men, who were armed with spears and shields. And the basic organization, the tactical unit of the legion at this time, which would number about 4,200 men, was the maniple. The maniple consisting of a pair of centuries, and these were arrayed in something called a checkerboard formation, where you would have essentially sort of like if you look at the five on a die, they would have been in that sort of formation where you would have one a gap, and then the next unit over, and then behind them in the next line would have been another unit. And presumably, when they actually engaged in battle, these lines would have actually moved forward to form one continuous line. That's not entirely clear, but that seems to be the consensus of what happened. The primary change that we see going forward, and this is the legion that the Romans used with great success against the Carthaginians during the Punic Wars, against the Greek phalanxes in the wars against Macedon. The primary change that we see from that legion, the so-called Polybian legion, to the legion that we see later on in existence in the first century BC, where we could call it the cohortal legion, is where the primary tactical unit of the cohortal legion was the cohort. They still appear to have arranged these legions, these cohorts, in three lines. And the basic difference that I see there is, and they would have simply just collapsed these legions for drawn them together when battle was joined, although that itself is not entirely clear either, is they made a larger unit, the cohort, into the primary tactical maneuver unit for the legion. Now, why this occurs, and this is my theory, which I think is probably the simplest explanation, is that for a commander to be able to issue orders to just a relative handful of unit commanders, say just to a handful of cohorts, as opposed to the maniples, would probably have made the deployment of the legion and its rearrangement when engaged in battle easier. And I think that that really is the primary difference. Certainly the Velites disappeared and the role of skirmishing became part of the normal legionary complement, because legionaries now all carried pilum, which were the thrown missile weapons. But otherwise, I think that that's the major difference between the legions. And I don't think that the difference would have been all that stark. It's a nature of equipment, but that's primarily, I think, I see the difference between the two types of legions in our period.
Now, the funny thing, of course, about that is that the current consensus of scholarship is that, like you say, the actual difference between the 3rd century BC Polybian legion and the 1st century BC cohortal legion isn't great at all. That in fact, the periods of reform that we used to hear about are now being turned into, that wasn't a reform at all. It was a gradual process over a long period of time. And that mainly involves the what are so-called reforms of Marius. So the idea, of course, is probably twofold, in the sense that there's a revolution in equipment and that there's also a revolution in enrollment, that to be a Roman legionary prior to Marius, you had to have a certain property qualification in order to be a legionary. You had to own land, and this idea that the Roman legionaries were citizen farmers who enrolled in the army and then went back to farming. And then after Marius, when he enrolls the proletariat who don't have a property qualification. Yes, that's what I'm saying. That you suddenly get this A, professionalization, and B, the loyalty of the Roman legionary shifts to, well, now you have men without property who are relying on their general to pay them, give them loot, allow them to, you know, plunder. And the issue then becomes that the Roman armies of the 1st century BC are tied more to their general than they are to the state. And you have the equipment, you know, that there's the introduction of mail armor and the standardization of that, and also the pilum with the wooden pin. Now, the funny thing about that is that the wooden pin pilum is now kind of like, that's we don't think that even exists. And mail armor had existed since the 3rd century BC, maybe even earlier. And so it had always been around. So it's not a reform as such, it's a process. And similarly, the enrollment of the proletariat into the Roman legions had occurred before Marius, and so is again a process rather than an event. Did I get that right? Did I miss anything out?
I think you missed out the fact that what we've got to be aware of is that it seems to be an oversimplification, that we're sort of being fed by our primary sources all of the time, that the Polybian army that we've been fed on for so long doesn't take into account, as this a point made in the current article, current edition of the magazine. It doesn't take into account the fact that one, Polybius is writing for a particular audience, trying to convince a Greek audience of the virtues of a Roman system in terms of military system and political system. So therefore, he doesn't necessarily go into all of the details in great depth in terms of the organization of the army. The structure that Mark just described in terms of the velites being the supposedly younger group, going through to the triarii being the older veterans as such, I think there's argument now being made that actually that might not be as accurate in reality, in terms of it could be a more matter of what people turned up with in terms of their equipment and actually are fitting in into the three ranks of what where they are suitable with the equipment that they've turned up with. And that's, I think, one of those things that possibly has been overlooked in the Polybian description. Likewise, at the other end of the scale, in terms of the Marian revolution of, letting in the proletariat and letting in, revolutionizing the structure of the army, that again has been fed by some fairly how can I say, some fairly wide statements about the impact of, say, the latifundi being developed. This is the large industrial-sized farms developing in rural Italy in the late 2nd, early 1st century BC, and that leading to a large an increase in the landless, jobless, looking for long-term employment being fed into the army. So, and again, affecting Roman politics. So again, we're sort of being fed a lot of very big sweeping statements, which for a long time we have accepted. And now looking at them in more detail, the information is there in our sources, but you know, it's looking at it.
So let me throw this into the mix. So one of the tenets of business strategy is that structure follows strategy, okay? So the idea is you don't build an organization and say, oh, let's use it this way. What you say is, we need something to do this. Let's build the organization. So I wonder, what is the catalyst then that really causes these changes to happen? Because for a great length of time, it seemed to work perfectly well, and then suddenly it doesn't.
Well, I think that probably ties into what Mark's just said, that it's perhaps a source-based bias, that what you've got is a Roman legion, which has conquered the world, you know, by the end of the 2nd century BC. They've conquered Carthage. They've conquered the successor states of the Hellenistic world. You know, that goes on until 30 BC. But, yeah, why change what ain't broke? But then, there's the 2nd century BC crisis where you've got, incompetent and corrupt generals and commanders, which again there had always been.
But Mary, why would not the trigger and the catalyst to use a word not be the enemy that you're fighting, right? So what I'm saying is, if a military strategy changes and they find that this three-partite structure that they've gone to war with, which worked very well in Italy for a great many years, and now they're going outside of the boot of Italy into Sicily, and they're going North Africa and Spain or whatever, and now they may be fighting guerrilla warfare or something, someone sort of says, we need a better way. And then they postulate that maybe having this cohort format is more maybe flexible, it's more self-contained. In a sense, it's easier to manage from a command and control perspective. Then now I've got three different kinds of troops, and the first line can only do certain kind of things, and I've got to swap them out to get the other people in. No. Whereas if you have one that's multi-purpose and flexible, right?
It seems more like it's hidden in terms of that change, though, because we're all looking for a key moment of change here. And I think this, what the sources are hiding is that, again, we've been making that faux pas just now of giving that idea of a monolithic Roman army as such, and ignoring the fact that every time you've got the Roman army going out and being active somewhere, it's not a matter of simply saying a continuous Roman army is in action. It is another legion or legions being recruited. They're being re-enlisted for each campaign, and they're being enlisted under another commander who's going to treat the situation in his own way. And I think we've got this idea that there's a plebeian structure and a legion structure under cohorts later on, but actually it's probably much more a situation of, that plebeian structure maybe is the general view of a certain period, but it's constantly going on to revolution as we go forward.
It's ironic that we call it by the observer who happens to be Greek, who's got nothing to do with it. And wouldn't it be interesting if we actually had the original, if you want to give it a label, whoever was the conceiver of this change, right? Because we sort of think about Marian reform and maybe...
I think the problem with that, of course, is again this idea that we're looking for key moments and key men who do this, Marius, Camillus. And the fact is that's not how it evolved over a period of time. And I think Mark's process of individual generals enrolling armies with different priorities, different, how I want to do this.
Different structures of, in terms of, how long you're with your troops in terms of saying a Scipio in it.
I think incremental change that evolves to a point where at some point in the first century BC, someone says, hang on a minute, this is different from what we've had. And yet, there's been a continuity of the Roman army, even though that is this evolving morass that changes with commanders.
But I also posit something regarding the nature of troop types. So, for example, it certainly does seem that from sometime around the mid second century BC to the early first century BC. There was a disappearance of the skirmishing Velites and the triarii with the spears, and that you had basically a common standardized legionary with pila, scutum, and gladius. I think that if I could just make a guess as to why the Roman legionary was standardized, is that as the empire grew, right, so as the Roman Empire is always taking in allies, but they were incorporating allied troops with different fighting styles, the need to use Romans as skirmishers pretty much disappeared. I think that role was pretty much given to someone else that would have been either non-Roman, or at least if they were Italian, they were not Romans, or probably from outside of Italy. And it would made more sense to take Roman / Italian manpower and turn them into standardized legionaries and allow skirmishing and other activity to be conducted by
that makes a lot of sense.
Roman troops.
But it's also interesting that Lindsay, that owes the simplification that Mark was talking about. We get Valites, Hastati, Principes, Triarii, and then there's, well, yes, but there's also the Rorari, and there's the Akensi, and then there's troops who are called Ante Signum and Post Signum, and you're like, well, hang on, where do they fit? And of course, these are different descriptions for the same. Yeah. So in front of the standard and behind the standard, who are they? Which troops are those? And so, you know, again, it's left to, and I think one of the problems is with Polybius, at least you've got someone trying to explain a system to a bunch of people who are not familiar with it. And so there is some detail there that others just go, oh, it's the Roman army. You know, the Roman army. It's the one we all know. You're like, no, we don't know it. Please tell us. No, that doesn't help us at all.
At the risk of being controversial, I'm increasingly not subscribing to the idea of gradual change philosophy. I've seen enough things in my own lifetime that it's amazing that there can be moments which shock people into doing radical things. The old methods don't work anymore. We have to do something because at stake are some very big things like our empire or our whatever they are, lives, right? The problem is, and you've mentioned it already, is the fact that we have so few sources who are not terribly good, really, from the point of view they're not like handbooks that you can, you know, tease out every single thing that you need to be able to explain things. They're, as you've just described, there are people who are trying to produce a general picture for an even more general audience, which is incredibly frustrating because they don't use terms, what's the word I want to look at? They don't use terms repeatedly and efficiently and, you know, accurately. So, I mean, just to give you an example, when you read Tacitus talking about the imperial army of the first century AD, and he's talking about, for example, there's the battle with Boudica, right? In fact, there they talk about lightly armed legionaries. You know, who the hell are these guys? What is all this about? Is this a thing that he just comes up with, or is that a real thing?
Well, funnily, exactly the same thing, but 300 years later, the Ammianus Marcellinus talks about lightly armed auxilia. And you're like, well, that's fine, except that by that point, the auxilia are the auxilia palatina, the standard legionary. What do you mean, lightly armed auxiliaries? Whoa. And they're the Batavi and the Heruli, who are the standard legions, because one of them's destroyed at the Battle of Adrianople. And so you're like, is this only auxiliaries with light arms, or is it just bring your light arms, we're running quick, we don't know. And they just throw these words into the mix, and they don't gloss them. And then sometimes they do gloss them. Like, I love the glossing of Clibinari to be, you know, baking tin men. You're like, oh, right, so they're covered in armor. Right, well, that's great to know that. Thanks for that. But most of the time, they just throw these words out that they expect the audience to read and understand immediately. And we, of course, 2,000 years later, have no hope. Or we have theories, which often can be proven to be incredibly far from the mark.
I think what I'm appealing to is the fact that just as we expect a modern army to be something of a learning organization, I was actually with the British Army guy today in supply chain and quality management, and they do post-action reports, after-action reviews of things. And part of the problem that they have is they don't do a terribly good job of it, as it turns out. So they make a lot of the same repeated mistakes. I think what's very interesting to hypothesize is that because you're talking about a citizen army that presumably when there's a need for a war, they all file out in the Campus Martius, they draw lots and off they go, and you know, they go into their assigned centuries and off they go. And then I think the point you were making earlier, Murray, was that the commander presumably has some ability to adapt the organization of those people to deal with a new crisis they hadn't had before. And if it works, they'll say, okay, we'll start doing that in future, maybe more often. Or people, and again, I have to wonder that, and are there not examples where particular men prove to be particularly valuable and they'll want to have them as a centurion each time they have to assemble a new army, because actually, can I have Gaius? Because he's really good. You know, don't leave him. I won't. So what I'm pointing to is a learning organization that does evolve its thinking and its organization in response. Again, structure follows strategy. So what we're missing in the historical record, and that's why I'm kind of pushing this point a bit, is the fact that I do think there are these points where what worked before doesn't work now. And now we have to make a fundamental change.
Then we've got another factor as well in terms of the men that you're talking about. Like you say, if there's a particularly useful centurion that they want to take on each campaign and whatnot, then we've got to come back to how are they recruiting? Because that, again, there's been a lot of assumptions made about that over the time. You know, are we actually talking about conscription? Are we talking about volunteers? To what extent, to what extent is it, okay, it's seen as a citizen's duty to do their military service in the Roman, society. But on the other hand, how much is that reality? You know, how much in terms of like a centurion, are they, wanting to do their time and get out, or are they looking for a career? And I think we've sort of got that idea that at the end of the Republic in the last century, especially, towards the civil wars, and okay, we get some of this from Caesar and whatnot, that there are men looking out there looking for making a career of it. But we can't be sure how much we're generalizing here.
And that increasing professionalization of the centurionate, that may actually be one of the underlying or at least hidden explanations for why there was this transition from the maniple to the cohort as your basic tactical unit. That is, in the same way that there may have been an increasing, large number of centurions who were very experienced, who could be relied on, and a general might say, these are the people I want, with me. That is, they could be entrusted with maybe a larger unit, and the general knew them, and that cohort may have been the new tactical maneuver unit because the centurionate was higher quality. And just also as an adjunct to that point, a cohort as a larger unit may simply have been larger, able to absorb more losses, and as opposed to having to be maybe a maniple that got mauled, have to be folded into some other unit somehow. A cohort may simply have been, because it had more men, would have had more staying power.
But if the maniples are that much more amateur, then does it really matter about how who's replacing who?
I have 3 points to make. Can I remember all three? I don't know if I can. First point is to what was just being discussed, that it possibly is a going back to the pre-Polybian legion, where we now think that it's war bands and that it's clientele of a particular aristocratic general. And so therefore, I want Gaius, and Gaius, get some guys, get those guys that can do the job. They'll be your century. Is very much the pre-Polybian war band, army, which you combine several war bands like the Fabi and all of those sorts of things. So does that continue? Is that a way of, get some guys together? Oh, I've got the crew that we need. That kind of, somehow they became British gangsters. And that idea that sort of that continues, and that's entirely possible, but it plays against the idea of this professionalization and this strict structure we have of the Roman army. To Lindsay's point, I think one of the things that's interesting is, yes, there probably are these moments. And like in the media today, one thing that happens today is a revolution, and then tomorrow that revolution is forgotten. And so the problem, of course, is we have historians writing hundreds of years later about this is what was going on. And I think it's like if you say, well, computers, they're the same as they always were. And someone would go, no, there was a revolution here and here and here and here and here and here. Yes, yeah, I'm writing a, you know, 200 years down the track, the difference between an Apple IIe and a Commodore 64 and the latest MacBook Air, no difference at all. And in vast historical scope terms, we're dealing with 50 years. So there's not this revolutionary change. There is a revolutionary change in the advent of the computer, but all the incremental changes between, you know, 1984 and 2022 can all be subsumed into a simple, yeah, computers. And we, with all that information, can go, no, but what about the revolution of 1997 and 2003 and 2009? It's like, yeah, they're all just in the computer. And I think that what you find perhaps is that in those, you know, Marius enrolled the proletariat, it is this instance of Marius being an individual general. He's coming after a whole series of other generals who've been unsuccessful. He has a different take on what he's going to do. Perhaps there's a manpower shortage. I'm going to take these people. You know, hey, you guys, I know you from my dodgy dealings in the back streets of Rome. Get some guys together, form a crew. We're going to make an army and I'm going to defeat Jugurtha. It certainly has and the problem is that may be part of a process. But it's also a revolutionary moment, and our sources go, that's the revolutionary moment. And we now go, it's not a revolutionary moment. It's a kind of a thing. Whereas it may have been presented in the media as a revolutionary moment. And the third thing has gone out of my head. No, it's not. It's coming back to the cohorts. I wonder whether the cohort evolves, because a maniple, you can't really go and say to a maniple, you go to that town and take care of business. They look like they're, you know, not being loyal. You know, I want you to restore their loyalty. It's like, well, they're not really enough of us to do that. Whereas a cohort, you can split a cohort off and go, right, you guys, go over there and secure that objective. And a cohort is a large enough small unit that it actually has some autonomy and some real firepower. Whereas I think a maniple or a century or a contubernum aren't big enough to make a difference in a sort of a strategic sense.
The distinction between a battalion and a company, perhaps.
Yeah, I think, you know, and all those 19th century histories of the Roman Legion, which don't use the Latin terminology, they use British terminology. And you're like, what? Okay, regiment, division, battalion, company, platoon, I don't know. I think, yeah, it's fascinating because I think the one of the things that's fascinating about scholarship, of course, is that it always swings like a pendulum. And so at the moment we're in the you know, there was no change, it's continuity, it's, you know, problems with the sources, and we're reading the sources wrongly. At some point there will be a reactionary pendulum swing back the other way. No, it was definitely this very strict moments of change, and that, you know, that's the history of scholarship. But I find that the whole evolution of these, you know, juggernauts, well, I say juggernauts, it wasn't a juggernaut, it was the Roman army. It was a continuity that the Roman army was always there and enrolled, but it's not this massive professional thing that it became. And I think that's probably one of the other problems with the Roman army, is what it became isn't always what it was. But people always view the Roman army through the lens of, you know, when you think about Livy, the Roman army in the period of Livy is this omnipresent organization. So talking about the Roman army in the same manner is sort of natural to him, even though the idea that it was not, and it was occasional and changeable and not given the same sort of structure, not helped by the fact that Livy's not a soldier himself, seems to kind of misinterpret his evidence or obfuscate and describe things that just make no sense.
And of course, they're dealing with a language where often they're imprecise anyway. I mean, when you say, you know, he's a pro something, or oh, that'll do it. It's a proprietor. That's what he meant.
Well, it's also, you know, we like looking for, and this is not just Roman history, this is Greek history too. We like looking for exact tactical definitions of words. If you use the word phalanx, it means this thing. No, it just means a group of men. Wait, what? No, it must mean this. 9,000 Macedonians. It can't mean anything else. And you find that with Latin sources too, that they may just be using you know, and I don't want to cause any ruckus, but if they say cohort just meaning a group of guys, you know, the crew, or the century just meaning the crew, that will mess with our kind of understanding of
that's exactly what's happened to the word cohort today, isn't it? I mean, listen to how people throw that around today in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, later on you get the cuneus, which is, you know, at the time of Boudicca's revolt, it's a wedge, and it's a tactical deployment of legionaries. You're like, we don't understand what it is, like a testudo. Oh, right, I understand what a testudo is. It's a tortoise. Right, good, great. And then when you go, right, where were they used? Well, there's this one occurrence, and then there's this other occurrence 400 years later, and that's all we have. You're like, oh, okay. But the cuneus becomes an irregular unit of cavalry later in the Roman Empire, not a wedge, just a unit. And then, of course, you have terms like cohort, which stay but change meaning. Auxiliate stays, changes meaning. And then you get the numerus detachment, just a number, just a group. So in a way, you've gone full circle. So you've gone from having a group of guys in a war band in the 5th century BC to a group of guys in a numerus in the 3rd century, 4th century AD. You're like, the thing's not changed at all. And that's the problem. And again, it comes down to our sources don't always give us that precision. When I say this word, I mean this.
So I can confidently predict in about 50 years, we'll actually do a reissue of this part two, revised to the current thinking, which will be the complete opposite, right?
Well, the most fascinating article to me was the one that talked about the Roman command, that imperium is not hierarchical. That, you know, a consul, a proconsul, and a praetor and a propraetor have the same level of imperium.
Well, that's why they had to introduce the proconsulare maius to make sure that actually this guy has more, because it's the same.
Exactly. This weird idea that they didn't outrank one another. And again, I think the problem with the analogy to British or German officer structure in the 19th century has caused this problem, because we think of major, colonel, general, you know, captain, lieutenant as a hierarchical order of chain of command. And so the idea that an optio, a centurio, right, legate, okay, they're going up the chain of command, like, no, because then it comes to a plateau where everyone has the same authority, and it just happens to be who's in charge of your army at that particular time.
Again, it's looking back, isn't it, in terms of the later idea that actually it does get, you know, slightly solidified in law later on, that the consul is the older of the two positions in terms of the supposed minimum age requirement for it. But of course, then you sort of look back in history and say, well, hold on, the praetor appeared, well, according to our sources, the praetor appeared much earlier than the consul and was the preeminent position of the early magistrates of the Republic. So therefore...
It means the man in front, as I understand, a sort of literal translation. First man.
I think later, for instance, much, much later, there's, I think it's a letter of Jerome, gives us the pay scale. And again, there's this idea that certain men get paid a certain amount, and then at some point then their money doubles, but not with each successive rank. Like there's like a band of middle management, for lack of a better term, and they all get that same double pay, and then the next one above that, they get an extra bit. You know, and again, we like to think of a professional Roman army because it's easier to think of, you know, men getting a certain pay for a certain length of time of their service, and then they retire, and then they can re-enroll, and they get more benefits, and all that sort of thing really fits into a thinking much, much earlier than it exists. And again, I think that's one of the things that Lindsay's saying, is that structure follows strategy rather than this sort of nebulous thing that just evolves, that there must have been some thinking around it.
It's interesting that you brought up Imperium. I mean, I just wrote an article, a blog for the other magazine, the other great magazine called Ancient History. Buy it, subscribe. Very good one. So I actually wrote a piece there on citizenship and in the context of punishment. Right. And the fact that civitas gives you protection against crooked or overzealous magistrates, for example, who are able to invoke their imperium in law, which is given for typically a year. And they can be pretty brutal in that year if they wanted, but it's always counterbalanced by the fact of accountability at the end of it. And they can be prosecuted, and they are. There are lots of examples of that. But the thing about imperium is the ability to command, and it means to command basically armed men. Right. So in the case of a civil magistrate, it's going to be someone with the famous lictors. And there's, you know, everything from like just one or two all the way to 24 if you're a dictator, with I think it's 12 each if you're one of the consuls. And it's this Roman recognition of power is ultimately about life and death. Right. So it comes with great responsibility, and it needs to be contained. It needs to be time limited. Because it's very dangerous if it's put in the hands of people who are not controlled. And you can imagine when you send a bunch of men who are all armed and they're going to go off to fight a battlefield, you're trusting to the system in a sense that they are able to manage their own restraint. You know, I mean, because, you know, a man who suddenly says, hey, I've got Imperium, I can go kill people. Whoa, I forgot. It's always done with the matter that they will go back to the Senate at some point and be accountable that I took a legion, we did this, and I'll say, well, why ever did you do that? And you sort of see in the accounts, the historic accounts, where they have to relate back what they did. And I suppose they're looking for the glory side of it, so they'll be praised and they'll be given a triumph and all this. But actually, it's an after-action report as well. It's, you know, so didn't I do good? Yes, you did. And a crown for you and a triumph, and off you go.
Yeah. But hang on, didn't you take the lives of Roman citizens? Ah, well, yes, because I was hailed as a pater patriae, so therefore I'm the father of my state, therefore I'm allowed to. There's a nice legal argument around that.
But it's in a sense, it goes to the heart of, I think, the Roman understanding of his res publica and where he fits in it, in a way that modern armies don't have that. I mean, the army is very separate than the civil world. And what I became more and more aware of is the fact that because free Roman citizens could be called to pick up arms and go fight for country, right? I mean, in a very sort of interesting comparison, it's just like the Ukrainians, the great heroes in Ukraine right now. I mean, men are volunteering and they're going to defend their country. Right. And they put their lives on the line. And that's what I see, in a sense, was what Romans were doing. And to Mark with the C's point earlier, it is really that as the empire grows, they begin to sort of say, we can actually farm that job out. We don't want to do the grunt work of doing this. We'll have a special group of people. They'll do the skirmishing, and they'll do, you know, we want the prestige stuff, you know, and this is where these sort of reforms. Maybe reforms. There's another word I prefer rather than reforms. Refinements is what I use rather than reform, because that appeals to the end where you're doing continuous improvement as opposed to reform, which sounds very much from bottom up.
Let's just call it tinkering. You know, that really works. I think it's interesting what you're talking about, the power of life and death, because, of course, with that imperium, and we think of, you know, the power to command armed men and, you know, the death penalty, which the lictors with their fasces gave them the power of the rods and the axes. But at the same time, the premier magistrate in the state explicitly has no imperium, and that's the censor. And he has the longest term of office because he has 5 years, the lustrum, as opposed to a consul or a proconsul who generally starts at a year and then gets prorogued into longer if necessary. But that in the sense of that civitas, the life, the censor who counts how many people are alive, literally, and enrolls the army and all of those sorts of things, trumps death, in the sense that the most superior Roman magistrate is the censor, who has maius auctoritas, and is sacred, can't command armies explicitly, but is the moral authority. And so that this sort of idea that the civilization will always trump the destruction of someone with imperium, supposedly.
Well, they're trying to make sure that there's a sort of purity, which is an awful word to use. But, you know, in politics, there are honorable, decent folks who will not be tempted by corruption and go do bad things.
Yeah, it's always the morally upstanding, you know, superior moral standing.
And I have to say that, you know, it's a sort of an alien concept to us now, because I think we're much more professional. Well, you know, I mean,
I think it's just the kind of people in the moral authority above us. You're like, really? I'm not. Whoa, no chance.
Well, I think what it points to is the fact that the reality on the ground was they were always bad people, always corrupt people. They were always doing it, which is why they had to have that person who had to literally sort of say, oh, so you've had a criminal record. You can't possibly stand for election. It's outrageous. Stand aside, because it happened. And in their striving to be better than they could be, You know, that was their response to it. I'm sure the Athenians and Corinthians had their version of it, but the Roman answer seemed to be a pretty good one, to the point that when it fell out of favor, Augustus brings it back for ulterior motives, of course, because then he can control who the people are as they're coming in to his Senate and so on and so forth. But it seems to be, as I think you're quite right to bring it, because ultimately the society can be called upon to go to war, and it wants to make sure its best men are available, the men of good character who have virtus in abundance, right?
I think it's also interesting looking at the spin that you get, because you get it in the Greek world as well. You know, poor old Alcibiades has a bit of a job done against him as whether he's morally corrupt, and you know that seems to be one of the accusations made against generals who may be unfortunate. It's not that they're a bad general. It's that they made the wrong moral choice. You know, or they took the lives of citizens, or they didn't rescue them in the famous, you know, the Arginusae and things like that. So it's a peculiar evolution of how it's presented. Now we have a question that I should probably get an answer to. Did the Roman Empire expect its retired legionaries who were resident in Colonia to act as a reserve in emergency or crisis?
Well, I'll throw this in the mix. First of all, you need to understand what the Colonia is. And there are two kinds, but the Colonia, I think that the question is talking, it would originally be called a Colonia Latina, which effectively was a replica of the Roman state in another place. So it could be, for example, in a former war zone. It could be in an area where there hasn't been any developed before. And the idea is that you create a society which is a clone of Rome, so that the inhabitants going there effectively have the rights of Roman citizens. It literally is a replica, to the point where they'll have, for example, the Capitoline Triad, which is the temple to the three gods, which are important, the same ones that appear in the Capitol Hill in Rome, that the same kind of idea of a Senate and the people's assemblies and all of the aediles and all the various magistrates that go with it. And the sort of pioneers that go off and build one of these things. And effectively, you can't just say, I'm going to go build a Colonia. It has to have the backing of the Roman people to do that. Three commissioners are sent out, Tresviri are sent out to do this. They are given a body of law, and we actually have a couple of those in various states of completion. Again, and this is in the issue of ancient history, if you'd like to go and buy the issue, because it's very good, by the way, which talks about colonialization. And I wrote the paper about colonies. It is this whole idea that that the Romans think of a colony as a means to do a number of things, one of which is to pension off its troops. So this is where the question is addressing the question of, you know, I've got retired troops. So it becomes more and more accepted that instead of just leaving to their own devices, they will be used as pioneers to set up a clone of Rome in an area which is useful to be. It could be newly conquered land. And from there, they emanate Roman ways and law, and they encourage people to go trade there and so on and so forth. And the hope is that, of course, as good Roman citizens, their ambassadors and their sons will go ahead and maybe then become recruits for the army. That they're in response to, are they expected to sort of defend the Roman Empire? Well, again, one of the recurring themes in all of our conversations is we go back to the sources, don't we? And we have to pick out individual chapters or events, and we think that those are somehow representative of a truth. And in this case, I'm thinking of two events which suggest that I don't know whether they were expected to defend the Roman Empire, but they would certainly defend their community. And what that means is if you've got retired veterans who are called emeriti in this particular case, if they know their community, their colonia is being attacked, well, of course, they're going to defend it. Are they required to? Probably not. But they will anyway, because they are, you know, they have the wherewithal, the means to do that. And in the case of during the Illyrian War of AD 6 to 9, there were two Illyrici that were known both by the name Barto, which is confusing because one is Barto the Desideriates, and the other one's Barto of the Broeci. And they, the story is this, is that Tiberius was commissioned by Augustus to actually go and launch a campaign against the Marcomanni across the Danube. And the governor of Illyricum is basically told, gather up your people. We're going on a big campaign. It's going to be a long one. So gather all the people. And I think it's either Tacitus or Dicastus, I forget who, makes the comment that so many of these Dalmatians and Pannonians are gathered together. They all go, hold on, there's a lot of us, aren't there? And what we do, we're actually going to defend the Roman Empire. Shouldn't we be actually defending our own territory? And what they do, instead of actually marching towards the Danube to join Tiberius and cross the Rhine, in fact, they revolt. And what they do is they turn on the capital city of Illyricum, which happens to be a place called Salona. In fact, it's got a really grand name. I had to write it down here. It's actually called Colonia Marcia Julia Salona, which is a rather grand thing. And it betrays that Julius Caesar had a hand in its foundation at some point. And as it turns out, it's almost a classic colony with all the setup in the city, and it has walls, and the retired emeriti, the retired legions, are able to defend it. They actually are besieged by the Illyrican rebels, and they withstand it. Go forward something like 58 years or so to get to the revolt by Boudica, and Boudica targets Camulodunum, which is actually a colony of Roman troops. And in fact, they fail to defend it. In fact, they're slaughtered in very large numbers. And what's very interesting is that they go after that because Camulodunum is really the leading city of newly Romanizing Britain at that point. London is a sort of trading city. And then they go to St. Albans, which is a municipium, which is a chartered city. So in the pecking order, a colony is ahead on the importance league compared to a municipium. And they burn Camulodunum to the ground. That's their first target. And afterwards, then they honorifically call this, I think it's called the Colonia Victrix or something, which is how we get the name Colchester today. So just taking those two examples, I don't think you can say they were obligated to defend the Roman army at the Roman Empire, but they would naturally want to defend their community. And they just happen to be armed, trained men, and that's what they know how to do. So I think that would be my answer to the question.
There you go. I'm going to call it Camulodunum. But, of course, the other thing is, of course, when you're in Norfolk and you're revolting, Camulodunum comes first, then Londinium, then St. Albans, which is kind of a natural order of march, which is what she follows. Interesting. Thank you for that, Lindsay. Anything else about the Roman Legion? Where do we finish with the Roman Legion? Where does it end up in, let's say...
Well, it ends up in part three, doesn't it? Which is no doubt what you're going to be writing at some point.
Well, yeah, there is going to be a part three, and then a four, and then a five, and then eventually part 12 will be in the late Roman Empire. What does the Roman Legion look like when we leave it in, let's say, the Social War, let's say 88 BC? What does it look like?
I was going to go to the Gallic Wars, for example, the legions that Caesar had, if I could go that far, and say that they're pretty much professional legions, because these are the legions that then become the basis for the imperial army, the imperial legions. You have some of the numbers that you continue onward. They're effectively professional legions, long service. I think that if you have legionaries that have been with the same unit, same legion for 10 years or so, these are not the spring summer levies that you had of the earlier middle Republican period. This is a professional legion, or very, very close to it.
I think it's still, we're being misled in terms of we've got this idea about Caesar's legions being, that moving into that professional or semi-professional, mode of what we come to think of as the legionaries. I think it'd be very interesting to, be able to have the same amount of coverage as what we get for Caesar's Gallic Wars on something like the Mithridatic Wars, and actually see under somebody like Lucullus how his legions compare to Caesar, and to say, are they really moving on into that, across the board under different generals into that semi-professional mode, or really, it wasn't that far ago before that you've got in the time of the Social War and the time of the Civil War, when you've got somebody like Pompeius Strabo, who of course is raising legions, from his own supporters, very much like Scipio did, taking his 400 or so retainers off to Spain with him. Pompey's doing it in northeastern Italy, early in the first century. That, to me, sounds more like a war band, I've got to say. And there's not that much time between Pompey's war band and Caesar's, what we're calling, professional army.
Well, even the idea... look at the disaster of Carrhae, and it's absolutely a disaster. If that's a professional army that gets wiped out, if that's a, you know, if that's a indicator of a professional band, and it's annihilated, that is a absolute disaster for the profession of being a soldier in Rome, as opposed to, well, Crassus raised his own army to go and fight this, you know, foolish war in Parthia, and it gets eliminated. In a way, as a private enterprise, it's much less of a crisis because it hasn't destroyed the army. Whereas if it is a professional army, you're like, yeah, we've got a gaping hole right now in this professional sort of class.
That's exactly what happened with the Teutoburger wall disaster, where you had three long service legions destroyed. And it's an interesting point because depending upon maybe how they were raised and also what the manpower status was, they could be more or less of a problem for the Romans if they're lost. It would seem, you know, this is now getting into the first century AD, which is outside, I think, of the rise of the legion.
That's number four.
The legion has risen, now. But, you know, it would certainly seem, if I could, you know, try and get into Augustus's mind, is that he wanted a Roman army that was as powerful and economical. And when you lose three legions and all of the auxiliary units that attend them, that's a disaster in, you know, no uncertain terms.
But what's interesting, you know, that for example, I playfully said about reform and refinement, and sometimes they are thought to be their Augustan reforms. In fact, it's really, really, to use Murray's really choice word, tinkering. So, for example, the only innovation that I could really find when I wrote my book, Augustus at War, apart from the professionalization in terms of service and pay and this sort of thing, really, but he maintains the cohort style of legion, which I have to imagine he, you know, borrowed from his adopted father, right? So he didn't make any changes there. He inserted himself as the imperator at the top of the whole organization, and his hand-picked legates, the legati legionis. And I think he professionalized the praefectus castrorum, which up to that point seemed to be a somewhat hybrid role of praefectus fabri or various other kind of things. But he had to say, and it seems to me that because that's the man that actually outserved each of the incoming and rotating out legati, right? He knew where everything was. So effectively, he was the man that actually could operate the legion from the point of view of its operational side. So you could argue that really he doesn't really do a lot. It's a little tinkering to
tinkering.
Murray's account.
Somehow the tinkering of the Roman legion doesn't quite, you know, sell the issue of the magazine. But of course, by saying that, you've leapt ahead two issues of the rise of the Roman legion. So we better close it up there and say that you can join us again when we talk about other things, but then, you know, join us again when we talk ancient warfare in a month's time. I would like to thank Mark, Lindsay, Mark, and of course Angus behind the scenes, and say looking forward to joining you once again to talk about all things ancient warfare. Thanks. Bye.